Wrestling with Mortality. What the topic, obviously, is not accidentally chosen to be on this weekend of Halloween, preceding the Day of the Dead, preceding the Election Day. It is something that almost all societies, as was outlined in the opening words, we have dealt with things like Halloween. We deal with Halloween because we human beings have some instinct that this is not the end. We have some instinct, and whether it's in hard wiring or whether it is in fact a fact, the instinct is clearly true. Every society, I mean, it's clearly true that we have the instinct. Every society has some sense of a separation of life and death, has recognition of it. Even animals recognize death and do their best to deny it. There is evidence of our pre-human ancestors putting dead bodies of their loved ones into burial pits and throwing food in. This lets you know that they recognized the fact of death but didn't accept its finality. There's this instinct that there is something else. Maybe it is whistling by the graveyard. Maybe it is wishful thinking. But it is so universal as an instinct and put into custom that we need to take it seriously. And take it seriously on any number of levels as opposed to taking it literally. When we look at the Halloween celebrations, we see that there are lots of things that we do in common with this, with the ghosts in our lives, the personal ghosts and the larger ghosts out there. In Western society, our tendency has been to laugh at them, to make them manageable in costumes, and to buy them off by giving them candy. In Latin America, the custom is to feed them, to invite them in, not to banish, but to accept, to open the doors, to build an ofrenda that recognizes and in some ways summons the people in our lives who have left our physical embrace and invite them symbolically into our homes, our hearths, and our hearts, and to recognize that. Personally, I find more spiritual and mental health in the Latin American custom of inviting the ghosts in as opposed to our Western stay away or whatever sign Unitarians make to keep ghosts away. I guess we wouldn't use a cross, would we? Although no one fears crosses as much as Unitarians, so let's at least be clear about that. And of course, one of the great things about believing in ghosts and having them for dinner, you know, maybe candy's okay. I mean, does junk food hurt you if you're already dead? I mean, maybe that's the wisdom in the way that we fuse the customs. Invite our dead in and let them have junk food because finally they can do it without guilt. Maybe. I'll get to that in a minute. Because of a near-death experience that I had. The other thing is that, and the part of this sermon that's called Wrestling with Mortality, wrestling is actually was an honorable sport and an honorable tradition until the 1950s, and Gorgeous George changed it all and made it into a kind of drama and a mockery. But Plato, the man of broad shoulders, which is what his name in Greek means, was a wrestler, and he wrestled with ideas, but he also wrestled physically. In the Hebrew Bible, Jacob is a wrestler. He wrestles with God. And I think the fight was fixed because God pinned Jacob, and Jacob came out of that encounter with a really bad back and sciatica. I'm not making this up. Whether the Bible's making it up or not is another question. But if you read the Bible, it's not in the movie, Jacob's back is wounded. God smites him on the hip, And part of the Jewish dietary laws is that you have to dissect out the sciatic nerve if you're going to eat the hindquarter of an animal. It is the first mention of sciatica, and it has been a tradition carried on from generation to generation. I know from my 3 back surgeries. Jacob was a wrestler, Plato was a wrestler, and we all are wrestlers with this blessing and curse of mortality. And it is both a blessing and a curse. Obviously, mortality is no issue to anything that hasn't lived. It is by living and by being human and sentient and at times reasonable that we understand the fact or the appearance of mortality, that our time on this earth has a limit. And there are those that say, this makes our lives absurd. On the contrary, this makes our lives precious. You don't have to buy into one political theory to understand that scarcity and value are related to each other. And the fact that we number our days and that they are not infinite brings our attention, or should bring our attention, to our lives, to how we spend each day. If, as the poet Marvel said, there were world enough and time enough, you could have all stayed home today, just read the paper. Actually, what's the point of reading the paper? There'll be another paper, another infant, well, maybe not another paper the way things are going, but another infinite set of days. There's no reason to get up to enjoy this beautiful weather, to watch a glorious sunset. It is the fact of our finitude that calls attention to our lives and makes them, or at least gives us the opportunity of finding in them how very precious they are. One of the great problems, of course, with youth is that youths are born sensing that they are immortal. And almost everyone who achieves a certain age says, you know, if I had really understood back then, I would have taken better care of myself. But it takes some time to appreciate the miracle of life. We also, beside wrestling with these issues of mortality and the mixed blessing, the fact that we live, the fact that our finitude calls attention to how precious it is, we also have to understand that our finitude is something that is also a biological gift. As Tom Robbins, I think, pointed out, that the first amoeba is still alive. It's just reproducing and reproducing and reproducing, but it is not evolving. It is not changing. We have the opportunity, because of our finitude, and our finitude is made possible only by the fact that we can exchange genetic information and pass it on to another generation. That's a nice way of saying sex. That sex makes all of this possible, and it's also an instrument where we are limited, that we pass on ourselves from generation to generation, and our future is not here eternally, but our future is here, in what we do, in what we achieve, in what we accomplish, in how we spend our time. That genetics is not simply, as I'm using it also metaphorically, the genes that we pass on, but also the memes that we pass on, the values that we pass on, our passions, our judgments, our priorities, our examples continue to live. Now, Halloween and the idea of wrestling with mortality also deals to some extent with denial. It summons up ghosts and spirits. I don't know literally about ghosts and spirits. I think I'm spiritual, but I'm not a spiritualist. I don't summon the ghosts from the past in order to talk with them. And yet, in my professional life, and in my personal life, I've had a lot of experience in attending to the dying and being present at the moment of death. And one of the things that I have observed in others is a sense, one, of peace, not of terror and fear. The living are afraid of death. The dying tend not to be so much afraid of it. It's often, as Walt Whitman said, they ask death to approach strong as a deliverance from pain and suffering and the dying of the light. But the second part is, almost inevitably, there is a sense that I'm going to close my eyes here and open them somewhere else. A not accepting of our finitude, only an accepting of the end of our time here. And this does not seem to be theologically related in my experience. I've met very religious, traditionally religious people who in those moments feel they're going to close their eyes and open them somewhere else, but without a lot of theological support. I also hardcore atheists who have a sense that there's something else. I'm going to close my eyes and I'm going to be on the other side. I do not speak to the facts, only to the instinct. I myself, when I was on a table in an emergency room in San Francisco, and I think around 1980 or 81, I believed that I didn't believe I was dying. I believed that I was dead. I was thrown onto a table as my throat closed and breathing. My nails started turning a really unflattering shade of blue. And they threw me on the table and they hit me with curare, which is a paralytic. And I didn't know, they didn't tell me what it was going to do. So the needle went in and I couldn't move, including I couldn't breathe. My mind said, ah, anaphylaxis, you're dead. My POV, my vision was up above the table, looking down at my body on the table. And I remember thinking, you could lose weight. And then thinking, ah, you're dead, you will. Not making this up. And then the next thought was, well, I wonder how long consciousness remains. The dog that didn't bark, what was absent was fear and panic. That's really good to have experienced. And it does focus one on dying is the scary thing for most people. Woody Allen was asked, Woody Allen's comment was, I'm not afraid of dying, I just don't want to be there when it happens. Well, I was kind of there when it was happening, and that wasn't bad, but that's what most of us fear. Most of us don't fear death. Most of us don't fear non-being. We don't want to miss anything. Most of us would like to live long enough for the Cubs to win the World Series. Most of us hope heaven lasts long enough for the Cubs to win the World Series. There are things that we don't want to miss, of course. But all of us, if death is non-being, all of us have been dead before. And it wasn't so bad. So death sting is not something that particularly bothers me or keeps me up at night. We wrestle with it. We wrestle with the value of our days. We wrestle with the import and the legacy of our lives, as we should. We take comfort and solace where we can, because there are people whom we miss when they are gone, and there are people that we hope will miss us when we are gone, but parts of us remain. I don't believe in ghosts, and yet they visit me all the time because they don't need me to believe in them. I'll come to a punchline and there'll be a moment, a pause, and a line, and I feel my mother's presence in my timing. I feel my father's charisma in performance, because when he was entertaining people, I remember how his eyes would shine and the energy that went through him. I channel Many people, in the corner of my eye, I see a relative. In a phrase that I write, my great uncle Jacob Zeitlin, who was a professor of English and an author, my great aunt Ida Zeitlin, who was an author, and as I am writing, I am hearing their voices. I'm not taking down their words, but I am feeling the rhythms of their prose. And in my sleep, the dead come to me all of the time. Not as fearful carriers of terrible messages, but as blessings, as memories. When there are tears in my dreams, it is because the dreams are ending. And my father, my mother, my uncle, my grandparents are slipping, my former wife, are slipping away from presence. These appearances are traditional. If you're looking for ectoplasm, you don't have to go to scary Halloween movies. You can go to the Iliad and the bodies and the souls of dead warriors who are hanging around and visible until their deaths are avenged. You can go to Hamlet and Hamlet's father, whose ghost hovers until there is justice done for him. And maybe all of our ghosts should hover until there is justice that is done. In the gospel accounts of post-Easter, Jesus arises and Mary comes to him and he says, no, don't touch me, because I am not fully ascended. I am spirit and some material essence, but at some point I will transition into a pure spiritual being. For me, this is a metaphor of how we grieve. We take people in their physical sense before us. We understand and recognize the fact of death. We grieve and see them out of the corners of our eyes. We look at a chair that they sat in, and we see them, and they are neither fully physically with us where we can hold them and hug them and embrace them, nor are they fully taken into a spiritual realm of memory. But they hover in between states. And this, to me, is the normal process of how we grieve, of how we begin and eventually complete the transition of having people in front of our eyes to inside of our hearts. There are those who say, if there is no paradise, then life is meaningless. I think that that's nonsense. If we make our lives meaningful, they are meaningful. If we are ashamed to die before we accomplish some small good, we make our lives meaningful. Death does not render life absurd. Life renders death absurd. When we live, and not everyone does fully and consciously, when we live, when we choose, when we do, when we build, when we care, when we love, when we do justice, we create a legacy of lovely ghosts to touch and to inspire future generations that hopefully will summon us, not buy us off with candy, but invite us into their homes and into their hearts for a day of communion where we embrace the full complexity of our precious limited time together here.